encouraging you. That's good to rock it tonight.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Filmmaker Barry Levinson's Baltimore is a place between North and South, between city and neighborhood, refuge and adventure. In intimate films like Diner, Tin Men, and Avalon, Levinson brought us a city and a country in transition, a world where identical row houses stretched as far as the eye could see, where boys silently kicked and screamed against manhood, immigrant families drifted apart, where the dreams and failures of the American dream turned like a gleaming Cadillac on the showroom floor. Levinson reached beyond Baltimore with hits like Rain Man, Good Morning Vietnam, Wag the Dog, and beyond nostalgia with the gritty realism of Homicide, Life on the Streets. Now, the producer, screenwriter, and Oscar-winning director has written a novel. 66 finds us back at the Hilltop Diner in the middle of the 1960s. The pies still beckon in the pie case, and the mysterious female is still discussed over fries and gravy. But outside the stainless steel sanctuary, the draft notices are in the mailbox. The war is on TV. And following in your father's footsteps is no longer part of the dream. Tonight on Point, memory, movies, and Barry Levinson. Joining me now from Fairfield, Connecticut is Barry Levinson, actor, director, screenwriter, and author of the new novel 66. Good evening and welcome to On Point, Barry Levinson.
Thank you.
It's great to have you. Barry Levinson, so many credits to your name in Hollywood, and now you've turned to write a novel. Why? Why step out of movies and go for the keyboard?
You know, it's a question that I can't really answer. I'm not sure why I went to this form. It wasn't a real ambition of mine, but somehow it seemed to make sense to do it in this way and to do this novel.
Were you tired of the great crowds of colleagues that you have in the movies? You wanted to sit alone in a room for a while?
No, not particularly. I mean, it wasn't, you write a screenplay, you're alone as well.
Yeah, true.
When you're doing the film, it's obviously more of a collaborative effort at that point in time. So there isn't any real reaction, and the reason that I did it, it just somehow... sometimes things come to you in a certain way, and I have always felt that it's better to be instinctive and just do that.
And what about the process, the experience of pulling your thoughts and your imagination into the covers of a book rather than on screen? What was the difference? How did it feel?
Well, there's an economy to a screenplay that you don't have to adhere to in a novel. When you think of a film, it's 2 hours, a little bit less, a little bit more. A novel, you pick it up, you put it down, et cetera. So there's not the same time, constraints to it. And on the other hand, you don't have to simply build in terms of a linear structure. You can be much more, as a book drifts back and forth in time and floats in and out of things and thoughts, et cetera, that you can't accomplish in a screenplay.
We want to dip back into some of your movies, Barry Levinson, and get your current thoughts on movies and memory and the new book. You've become such a miner of memory, particularly through Baltimore, but not only through Baltimore, particularly of the 50s and 60s, but really not only even of those periods. Avalon was a big film of yours in 1990. I'd like to just listen to a clip here where memory is the issue.
He brought my father over in 25.
Yeah. 25?
William died 1919.
25? It was later than 25.
He came the same year that we brought Belle and Edith over.
Belle and Edith came after.
After?
Yeah, after.
It was 26.
Yeah, Gabriel, what's the difference? He came to America, right?
It's a big difference between 25 and 26. One is 25 and the other is 26.
All I'm saying is, who cares if it was 25 or 26?
Jules, if you stop remembering, you forget.
Barry Levinson's 1990 film, Avalon. Oh, I love that scene. And how the immigrant family's around the table, and they're debating, and nobody's quite sure, and memory's being carved up and debated right there along with the turkey or meatloaf or brisket or whatever it was. I forget now. I guess it was Thanksgiving.
Thanksgiving turkey, yes.
Yeah. You write in the prologue of your novel, 66, you quote your grandfather, "If I knew things would no longer be, I would have tried to remember better." You've ended up being one of Hollywood's great rememberers for Baltimore and for the country. Did you set out, Barry Levinson, with the idea in mind that you would turn to memory for so much of your life's work?
No, not actually. It would not have occurred to me. You know, memory, in a sense, to remember is not the motivating force ultimately. I think you just try to make sense out of certain things in your life and situations that have happened in the past. And that, to me, has been an area to explore. But to explore it in a kind of very ordinary fashion and with just very ordinary type of talk. And so I've picked, now this being, you might say, the fifth of these Baltimore pieces, is to take different times, a different era, different issues, different cultural things taking place, and try to look into that, because what's happening today is all based on yesterday, obviously. But, you know, sometimes there's some kind of relevance to it. So I kind of try to deal with those issues in a way that satisfies me first.
So the memory itself, or the process of remembering, is not the point, but yet you're clearly working to bring it up with a kind of real verisimilitude, real accuracy. We just heard in the clip from Avalon that kind of cacophony of back and forth. It's like the real Thanksgiving table in an immigrant household. Are you hoping that the viewer in that case, or the reader in the case of the book, sits and looks at that and learns something, remembers something about themselves, learns something about themselves? Or is it just Barry Levinson, you know, wading in for the pleasure of reliving it?
Well, I think what happens is you start with yourself and you write specific to that. And sometimes that has the most relevance to other people around the world. I mean, it's odd to talk to people from Norway about Avalon and how it's just like their family.
Right.
You know, I don't know what their, family life was like, but somehow they make a connection, totally different culture. And I talk to a lot of people all around the world and they say, oh, yeah, that was just like, you know, when I was growing up, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not obviously, but there is something that connects in other people. And so I've just continue to do what seems specific to me, and sometimes it has a universal sensibility.
And what about you as an artist? Baltimore figured so big in your early films, Diner, the first big film, and then Tin Men, Liberty Heights, Avalon. But you've got many films that have nothing to do with Baltimore.
Right.
Is it a different sensation for you if you know you're cranking up to do something about the old home turf or you know, something that's very Hollywood or very Washington or very sci-fi? Do you begin from a different state of mind?
Well, yes. I mean, I think each project, whatever they've been, I've been enthusiastic about that. But I think, you know, the Baltimore ones, I specifically know the details. So if I were location scouting, I'll say, no, we have to be here in this particular area, this kind of house, et cetera, because it's so close. And you're literally almost stepping on old footprints at times. So that, because of that, there's a slightly different sensibility.
Barry, tell us about your first move to Los Angeles and then from television into movies. You did a lot of comedy writing on big shows that people knew, the Tim Conway Show, the Carol Burnett Show, and others. At some point, you met Mel Brooks. Was that the transition moment toward movies?
Yes, because for me, it was like an apprenticeship. What happened is I got hired to work with Mel. And, we would meet in the morning in a deli and we would talk about all kinds of things. Then we go back to the office. There were four writers altogether, and we would sit there and we would, you know, throw ideas around for up until lunchtime. Then we had lunch together. Then we worked for a couple other hours after that. And so the writing process was, this almost little communal thing, and then all during the filming of it, the editing of it, the marketing of it. So in a 3-year period for two films, I got a chance to really see the whole process.
This and is that was silent like movie and high anxiety.
Yeah. So it was a great experience for, you know, me to get a sense of what did I want to say, do, etc.
And how did it work out that you actually got the chance to do Diner? What producer or who stood up for you and said, yes, I'm going to underwrite this?
Well, first, Mel was the one that said to me, you know, I would tell him some things. You know, you ought to write about that. You should write that. And then one day it began to make sense to me in terms of what it was all about. And Then I wrote Diner, and Jerry Weintraub, who was a producer, read it. Mark Johnson, who used to work, who worked as a second AD on High Anxiety, and I'd stayed friends with, was involved, and we were lucky to get it set up. You know, it was a cheap movie, didn't cost much, and that was my first break.
And standing up to be the director, it's such a kind of glorified role in the way it's depicted. Do you remember it feeling glorified then, or was it terrifying?
Well, I mean, there's nothing, you know, there's nothing glorifying about doing it because you're in the process. You're there, you're on a location, you've got a bunch of actors, it might be freezing out, you know, et cetera. You know, it's, and you're just trying to get something to feel and look like you think it should be. What are the rhythms of that scene? What do you want to accomplish? What shots do you want to do? So that's all you're involved in. There is nothing else other than get it on film.
Let's go back and listen to just a little bit of Diner with Eddie, Shrevey, Billy, and Modell. Typical late night in the diner doing their regular thing.
You want to finish that?
Yeah, I'm going to finish it. I paid for it. I'm not going to give it to you.
If you're not going to finish it, I would eat it. But if you're going to eat it, you'll...
What do you want? Say the words.
No, go ahead. You're going to eat it. You eat it. That's all right.
Say the words. I want the roast beef sandwich. Say the words, and I'll give you a piece.
Would you guys cut this out? I mean, every time. Anything.
Well, if he doesn't talk, he just...
Well, you know what he means, right?
Yeah, I know what he means, but he beats around the bush. He beats around the bush. If he'd say the words, I'd give him a piece.
If I wanted him, but wouldn't I ask you?
No, then ask. You know
you just let it go.
You know he wants
You're
it.
Annoying. Yes,
I'm annoying. I'm annoying. I'm trying to eat a meal by myself.
If you want to give him the sandwich, give him the sandwich. If you don't want to give him the sandwich, don't.
I don't want to give him.
Well, then just eat the sandwich. And shut up.
Well, look at his eyes.
I ask one simple question. You get it. You know what your problem is? You don't chew your food. That's why you get so irritable. It lumps you up like roast beef in your heart. It just stays there.
Oh, Modell, you're really, really getting me mad now. My blood is boiling.
You don't like it.
I'll take the sandwich.
No,
okay,
don't.
Fine, I'll take the sandwich.
See what you do.
What are you blaming me? You took the sandwich. I'm sitting, I'm having a cup
you
of
want
coffee.
This?
That's it. No.
I don't want
it.
Fine,
I do.
Barry Levinson's 1982 Diner, his new novel, is 66. Barry Levinson, you're famed for pulling good performances out of actors and actresses again and again, a kind of natural delivery and very spirited delivery that sometimes they may not have managed again after working with you. How do you do it?
I don't know. I mean, I just do what, you know, comes to me in terms of credibility, in terms of small moments that you need to explore. I mean, Diner is only small moments. Diner is trying to find the you know, it's like you could have a movie with all these big things going on. So how about a movie that would take all the things that would have been in between, the ordinariness of it all, and somehow try to make that entertaining? And so that's all I've really tried to explore in a number of different pieces. I mean, when I first, you know, showed the studio Diner, I mean, they were appalled by it. You know, they kept looking for the so-called big thing, and it didn't have that. And that ordinary, you know, diner talk really hadn't been explored at that point in time.
Did the actors look cross-eyed at you when you described what you wanted them to do? They're clearly doing it with gusto there, but did they ask you, where's the big thing?
No, I mean, look, that they, you know because this is the road we were going to go down. When you get involved with actors, they have to understand what you want to do, what you're trying to accomplish. And so everybody understood the nature of the piece.
And do you still suffer from the diner, I don't know, the diner love years later? Are people still waiting for Barry Levinson to keep making diners?
Well, I mean, it's nice that they would like that. You know, I'm not that interested in going back and doing the same thing. You can always be criticized on the other side and say, well, look, you've gone back and you've done various things and there's been a diner. But, I mean, I think there's a million stories to explore, you know, along the way. But I wouldn't want to continue, you know, Diner and what happened to the guys, that type of thing.
Diner was in the 50s. Barry Levinson's new novel, 66, is clearly in the 60s. We'll be back in just a moment with more of Barry Levinson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Train I ride, 16 coaches long. Train I ride, 16 coaches long. Well, that long black train carried my
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with filmmaker, director extraordinaire Barry Levinson. He's out with a new novel, 66, all about the 1960s. And again, in Barry Levinson's style, a group of young men wading into their own times, wading into an awful lot of change in that decade. Barry Levinson, we've got another war going on now. Of course, that was a big part of the 60s. And I wonder, when you look out at the war in Iraq and the kinds of reports that we're getting back, the way that this week the administration is bringing out all the heavy guns to say everything's going just fine. We've heard people refer back to LBJ looking out at the Vietnam in the 1960s. It's not anything like ratcheted up to where Vietnam was. But when you look at the dynamics of what's going on to date, does it bring that decade's war to mind, or does this feel all new?
No, I mean, it does feel rather similar to me, you know, in the way that it suddenly starts sneaking up on you. Vietnam, we didn't really know much about it. You know, some incidents happen. We sent some troops. Then we had to send more troops. And then you hear about unfortunate, you know, the daily casualties of it. So, I mean, it does feel very much like the beginnings of what happened in the 60s.
And what about the wag the dog dynamic? 1997 was a very busy year for you. You came out with Sphere and Wag the Dog. And, of course, that was all about manipulating images to lead the country around. I suppose in the media age we live in now, you could look out at any moment and feel manipulated. And then, you know, who's paranoid and who's paranoid
about
being paranoid?
I mean, whether we're paranoid or not, we are being manipulated on a daily basis. You know, that is, in fact, true. And that's how, you know, politics works in very, very, you know, different ways of feeding information that's not necessarily, you know, correct, bogus, creating things that never existed and creating their own stories that we buy into. The deception of it all works in many, many complicated ways.
And I suppose it works whatever the agenda of the leader. I mean, if you had these days in the media age, the ideal leader would need to use images to motivate the nation. An unscrupulous leader would also, of course, use images to manipulate the nation. It all seems to come right back down, in a way, through those images to the integrity of the person or the people in leadership positions, doesn't it?
Well, it does, but I think it goes beyond that, because integrity is one thing. What we have now learned is that television is such a dynamic force, and the visuals and how to handle television is part of our lives. So the big question is, if you are a political figure and you have an agenda, is how to use television. It may start on the most simple thing of just appearance, and then it goes from there. What do you say? What don't you say? How do you say it? How good a statement it can be so that it can be repeated very quickly on the news programs, etc. There's so much that goes into it now that there is nothing that's really pure in terms of thoughts and ideas. It's all been sort of filtered into basic ideas. I mean, the Schwarzenegger campaign is a perfect, you know, a perfect scenario. You say, look, you get a guy who's a superhero. He never played an average person. He's a superhero. Mm-hmm. And therefore, he can just say those little quick, short statements. He can stand there with a broom in his hand and saying, we're going to sweep out Sacramento. Just these little quick bites. And, you know, enough people can buy into it. And there's enough, I think, frustration for what goes on that we'll suddenly buy the next product and hope that maybe that product will work.
So if everyone's manufacturing a view of the world, a view of reality, what's your sense of the movie that the Bush administration is making in the last couple of years, Barry Levinson? If you had to give a synopsis of it, what's the movie?
Well, that's a hard thing to say. I mean, it's a hard thing to say. I think they all play on the same ideas and kind of rework it. I mean, you're seeing this administration is building the idea of patriotism in a certain way. And if you view things this way, you're patriotic. If you view things that way, you're not patriotic. You know, we play on a lot of these kind of things that we do respond to. Because, you know, look, I mean, you know, no matter what in this country, how we may differ, there is a great passion for America and its basic ideals of democracy. And then what happens is you find a way that the administration and each administration will manipulate that the people it goes on and on and on, and it gets more devious and more complex because we learn, you know, it's an accelerated thing. We begin, you know, if you go back to Nixon and Kennedy, you know, Kennedy was tan and Nixon wasn't, and all of a sudden, you know, Kennedy was came off as vital and Nixon wasn't. And so there was the beginning of what does it look like, the cosmetics of it all. And now it just keeps evolving, and we create images of people, and they're not real. Nothing is real. And that's a scary dynamic to be faced with.
But it's not just random images. As you say, it's very carefully considered. There's a whole...
Which
means there's a fundamental storyline or view of the world in the same way that a Hollywood director would come to a new project with a storyline or view of the world.
Yes.
And I wonder if you can't plumb out, you know, kind of the storyboard in the White House.
Well, it's very hard to give you that story because parts of the story don't make sense. If you were writing a screenplay, you would, and of what's happening now, you'd say, well, we have to do something here because this doesn't make sense.
And yet it, it keeps being pumped out.
Right, right, yes. But if you looked at it from a true, you know, writing a story, you say, well, this is illogical. We can't, how are you going to make that work?
Maybe that's the difference between Hollywood and politics. In politics, it doesn't have to make sense. It just has to work in terms
of... For the time
and bringing people along.
Yeah, and then change the story later on. I mean, weapons of mass destruction was the story, and that's how we got involved. Later on, weapons of mass destruction, well, we'll find them. Eventually, we'll find them, and then we move on to some other issue. And another thing that keeps us involved and makes us feel as if there's a purpose to it all, because we do have to invent some other reason. And we go down that road, and we buy into it, unfortunately, for a certain period of time, and then there's a switch that takes place.
We're talking about
a disconnect periodically, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yes, we do. We're talking with Barry Levinson tonight. Let's listen back to just a little bit of 1997's Wag the Dog. Here's Robert De Niro talking about his plan to create a war to blow another story out of the headlines.
Tell me this again.
Glennon?
Tell me again.
Look, don't worry about it. It's nothing new. During Reagan's administration, 240 Marines killed in Beirut. 24 hours later, we invade Grenada. That was their M.O. Change the story, change the lead. It's not a new concept. White people, we touched on. We'll talk more about it.
We can't afford a war.
We're not going to have a war. We're going to have the appearance of a war.
We cannot afford the appearance of a war.
What'll it cost?
But they would find out.
Who's going to find out?
The
American people?
Exactly.
Who's going to tell them?
Huh?
What'd they find out about the Gulf War? One video of one bomb falls down a chimney, blows up the building. The building could have been made out of Legos.
You really want us to go to war?
That's a general idea.
With who?
I'm working on it.
Robert De Niro and Ed Heche, 1997, Wag the Dog. They're working on it. And,
right.
And everybody's still working on it one way or another. Of course, in all your films or in the kind of syncopation of your films, the one after the other, there's ordinary life going on while whatever big machinations are going on. In your new book, 66, you again have a group of young men. They've been raised in one world with one set of expectations, and in 1966, everything's changing gears. I want you to read a little something for us, but first, fill us in on the book, Barry Levinson. What's it about?
Well, to me, this is the first time I dealt with my generation specifically. You know, in the previous works I did, it wasn't really my generation. This one I thought of when I turned 13, that was the beginning of rock and roll, and we were defined as the rock and roll generation. Mm-hmm. By 1966, the age of 22, 23, something like that, suddenly you're face-to-face with a new generation, which was the counterculture hippie generation. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, you realize you're no longer the kid on the block, and change had taken place. And out of a naivete out of it all is sometimes when we're young, we never realize that things will change. We think things will remain the same forever, mm-hmm. and obviously that's not the case. And that was the moment when you realize the world is never going to be the same again. And this collision of these two generations, even though they may be separated by only several years, is a frightening thing to it. Picture the idea that you take someone from the 50s into the 60s, and he's suddenly with a suit and a tie. He's got Brill Cream in his hair. It's all kind of groomed, and all of a sudden you're face-to-face with another guy. His hair's all over the place. He's wearing, denims, Levi's, wearing jeans.
He's not wearing your values anymore.
And all of a sudden you look completely different, and you were an older person, even though it's a couple of years difference between them. And all of a sudden if someone calls you sir, it's like, might as well get stabbed in the heart. Those two groups, and where do you go from there? Where do you go when you realize that there is change that you can literally see, and it's in your face? And what happens? What are we about? What are we, and who are we? That's the simplest way I can try to explain it.
Yeah, no, and I guess anyone who's lived through one of those transitions can feel it, though the transition in the 60s was so visible, so tangible. The canyon
was so wide.
It was
a huge, shocking change. And it happens periodically, and it's inevitable. But it doesn't mean we're always aware of it.
There's a passage where the book's narrator, Bobby, has decided to drop out of law school, and he's sitting with the guys, mm-hmm. and his friend Eggy wants to know why. I wish you'd read a bit of that for us.
Well, this could be dangerous, me reading.
All right, we'll brace ourselves.
I've been at various bookstores, and I never actually even attempted it. Something that would – anyway, I'm going to give it a shot here.
Barry Levinson, right? From his new novel, 66.
Talking about him in law school and the fact that he dropped out, and Eggy says, then why did you do it? Why did you go there in the first place? He's because I saw Paul Newman and the Young Philadelphians. He had great suits, got the girl, he seemed hip. He was an income tax lawyer in the movie. I figured I could be him. The realization that I was trying to be a character in a movie was frightening to me. My fantasy was that I would walk into that law office, sit at my desk, and be a lawyer. But then what? What was the next moment after that? What would I be doing all day long? The movie didn't have any scenes where Paul Newman was actually working on income tax law in his office, but I was going to spend the rest of my life behind the desk doing what? Saying what? I didn't really like the fact that I was so impressionable, too caught up in images that weren't mine, but I think I'd always had that since I was a kid, since childhood. When I was 3 years old, I used to stare at pictures in Look magazine. I once turned to a page and saw a man and a woman sitting on a park bench on a nice sunny day. They were both smiling. I would stare at that picture for the longest time until I could make the man and woman come alive. Then to see them actually get up and walk away from the bench, leave the park. But once they left, I couldn't visualize it any further. My young imagination couldn't take it beyond that. Where did the couple go? Why were they smiling? Why did they come to the park in the first place? It all bewildered me. Too many unanswered questions. But to me, photos were never just images frozen on the pages of Look or Life or Collier's magazine. They were all part of a game I was beginning to play, little stories I was beginning to invent.
Barry Levinson from his new novel, 66. And Barry Levinson, you have invented a lot of stories. I wonder that you're reluctant to read. I mean, you were an actor in your time. Mel Brooks got you on screen.
Yes, yeah, I did Dennis the Bellhop in our takeoff of Hitchcock movies, and I did the Psycho scene. But I never wanted to act. I mean, I studied theater for a few years, and I was there on a daily basis, did a lot of different plays, and I did some, stand-up with, Craig T. Nelson, who's an actor. But it was not something that, I really wanted to do.
When did you get the sense that Barry Levinson, can tell stories? I know how to reach out into the world or down into my imagination and pull up a vision of a compelling story. Was that did you know that from childhood, or did it come later?
No, I think what happens is we have abilities to do certain things and we don't necessarily explore it. I think for me it would have been just a slow process to realize you could tell. You could tell stories and hopefully, pull people into it. But, I think you have to have an ability to do that. And so I sort of snuck up on it in a way. I worked in 3-minute sketches and worked on other people's movies, and then I began to write a little longer and a little more complicated work, and then until I finally became my own.
And though you're looking at the 60s in the new book, so much of your early work and later was really focused on the 50s. As you say, that wasn't your generation. You were a little behind that, a little later.
Right.
Why the 50s then?
Well, I mean, I've done actually Avalon is mostly in the 40s, late 40s, mm-hmm. early 50s, mm-hmm. late 40s into the 50s. So I kind of wander in and out of those periods of time. I think that was a defining period. I always, you know, come back to the idea of television, had the influence of television, which really began almost 1950, 48. And I think that is one of the invention that's had the greatest impact in the 20th century. So I have been kind of hovering around that period of time for different pieces.
And immigrants have been so important in your work. When you look at the American immigrant population today, and it's practically as big as it's ever been, does that resonate to you as material for the movies, or is that someone else's material?
Well, I mean, each group, you know, will come up and explore their own stories. That's just the nature of it all. You know, different groups come in with their own storytelling ways and trying to explain, what went on in their lives, etc. That's invigorating in a way. That's what makes us as a country so fascinating, that we do continually make these kinds of changes that take place. Culturally, etc. That's the most stimulating part, I think, in this nation, and why it keeps us vital.
I mean, thanks to you and others, we have a strong sense of the immigrant community of the 40s, the 50s, even if they'd been around for a while. It'd be fascinating to see and how that generation, those generations, latched onto the American dream. It will be fascinating to see how Hollywood and a new generation of immigrants trace their step onto the American dream path or not.
Yes, it would be. I mean, right now, you know, Hollywood is in a period of really not dealing much with human beings, period. You know, it's much more into just fantasy and cartoonism. But you would hope that, you know, some point in time we'll get back to people and things in a way that's interesting as opposed to the trend right now.
We're talking tonight with Barry Levinson, filmmaker, director. His film list is As Long as Your Arm, Diner, Tin Men, Avalon, Liberty Heights, Sleepers, Fear, Wag the Dog, The Natural, Disclosure. And on it goes. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Hey, mama, don't you treat me wrong. Come and love your daddy all night long, all right now. She knows how to shake that thing. All right, now, now, now. Hey, hey. Hey, hey. Tell your mama, tell your pa, I'm gonna send you back to Arkansas.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Barry Levinson, filmmaker, director, screenwriter, and now first-time novelist. 1988, he directed Rain Man, Dustin Hoffman, and Tom Cruise in a role that really took him new places. Let's listen to just a little bit of that, where the Tom Cruise character Charlie is looking to get his autistic brother Raymond out of the institution where he's living.
Listen, my father died. You know that he died last week? Did they tell you that?
I don't know.
You don't know if they told you, or you don't know what dead is? That means he's gone. He's not with us anymore. He's at the cemetery. You wanna go see him at the cemetery, Ray?
I don't know.
Does that mean maybe? Does that mean maybe you want to go?
I don't know.
You know, I live in Los Angeles. I thought maybe you'd go to Los Angeles, like to see a Dodger game. Go see the Dodgers play.
Today's an off day.
Oh, you don't have to go today.
Monday, no game schedule.
Just thought maybe you'd like to go to Los Angeles with me, you know, go see Fernando Valenzuela pitch.
Fernando Valenzuela pitch Saturday, not scheduled to pitch till Wednesday.
He's going to pitch on Wednesday?
Wednesday.
Well, I'm not doing anything on Wednesday.
Yeah, Wednesday.
Let's go to L.A.
Yeah.
Come on, Ray.
Of course, there's a long way to California, and I'm definitely not supposed to be off the grounds for more than 2 hours.
Rain Man, 1988, Barry Levinson's film there with Dustin Hoffman and Tom Cruise. Barry Levinson,
I'm still fascinated by how exactly you lead actors to their performances. Dustin Hoffman was a very experienced actor already. Tom Cruise was not. Still a pin-up boy by reputation, and you got quite a performance out of him. How did that happen?
Well, I mean, I don't think there's any great secrets to it. I think he's, you know, a very talented actor, and it was a role that he could really shine in. And I think all you try to do is set up the circumstances so that they can be comfortable, so that your that sensibility comes through in terms of what, you know, the goals are, et cetera, that apply to acting.
But I wonder about the psychology of it. Was there a moment where you sat down with Tom Cruise and said, Tom, this has been your career. You've got a lot of potential. I think we can do something special in this film. Here's what I want you to attempt.
No, I didn't. I mean, you just basically give him the material. We spent some time rehearsing. We would go over little things, moments, et cetera, things we can try to explore when we're actually shooting it. And that's basically it. I don't think you want to set it up that there's such high expectations, because that has a tendency to intimidate. My thing in terms of directing, the key thing has always been to create a comfort zone that behavior comes out.
How much do you want the actor to fill in an outline that's already in your mind, and how much do you leave open field for the actor to create?
To me, I would call it a controlled freedom. There are certain things we have to accomplish, and what else can we get beyond that? So therefore, I'm always willing, whether I write the script or someone else writes the script, and we've got that, is there something better than that? Is there a better moment than that? So I'm willing to challenge the script at all times, and sometimes moments will happen that take off. And if it happens that way, great. And if it doesn't, you have to have a strong screenplay, you know, in the beginning. So this is all, in a sense, like those extra moments, and I'm always looking to explore those.
Rain Man, of course, was about two men, brothers in very special circumstances, but men in one another's company and leaning on one another and entertaining one another, supporting one another, a very common theme throughout your movies. It makes me wonder who your models of male behavior were.
Well, I mean, I guess there's, you know, several. I mean, obviously my father would be extremely influential, even though when you're younger, you always resent that. The idea that, you know, how he thinks and feels, expresses himself about certain things and the values that he has. Initially, there's a resentment to it. And then all of a sudden, later on, you discover a lot of things he said were true. And then I've had certain friends that have been very influential, and a couple, you know, teachers. Without them at the right time, I probably would have gone in a different direction.
When you live, when you look out at society today and the way people interact, are there still diners where men sit and have the kind of interaction that you depicted there?
Yeah, I think it evolves in some way. More things change, the more, you know, more they stay the same. I think all those things are true. I mean, there's always a place where people have to hang out. You know, it just is. They need to have some kind of interaction with one another. And it just all can happen in the workplace. So there has to be an outlet, and there is, and you'll find that, you know, men, women, they need some kind of an outlet, somebody to talk to. I think that is not going to change. It's the nature of people. I think we need to be in groups at times and express certain feelings, you know, not necessarily real deep feelings or whatever, but we need to have that in our lives.
And is that always good grist for the screen, that kind of intimate repartee, the back and forth, the support?
I think it's an interesting thing to always explore, because it tells us about, you know, the human phenomenon. I mean, what's so great is, you know, on one hand, you may say, gosh, it's so ordinary. On the other hand, it's the ordinary that makes us as the human race so special, because we do outside of, you know, I mean, a lot of times you see movies and all these big things and all of that stuff that goes. But on a day-to-day basis, this is what happens. We go to the movies, we see some friends, we go out, we'll do this, minor things, we go to the market, and somewhere within that, we are engaged and entertained. And then, therefore, how do we look into it? Because I hear conversations in restaurants, you know, to me, that are extremely funny in how we react with one another. And you overhear little fragments, and you realize, boy, we are really special, but we don't always acknowledge or understand it.
Where you stand in your career today, Barry Levinson, are you free to make whatever film you like?
No, not by a long shot, no. And in some ways, it's more difficult because there are certain kind of films which are popular now that I'm not that interested in. You know, you have to find that balance between what they're interested in and what you're interested in, because I couldn't imagine spending nearly a year and a half or 2 years of my life on some project that would just bore me to death.
even if the production money might be there, the market's not always there, you're saying?
No, I think there's a shift because we're also dealing – again, it gets back to television. Television is what sells tickets on an opening weekend. So even movies that aren't that good, they can open them very well for a weekend, and then word of mouth gets out and they collapse. But they do have that big weekend, and they can put up that number one film in America.
Right. Barry Levinson, we thank you for the films you've made that last. They're terrific, and thanks to the new novel as well, 66. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
For more on Barry Levinson's films and his new novel, 66, visit our website at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
I was born by the river in a little tent. Oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know.
In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
Remember what we saw on the morning of 9/11, and knowing the nature of these enemies, we have as clear a responsibility as could ever fall to government. We must do everything in our power to keep terrorists from ever acquiring weapons of mass destruction.
I came to this office to confront problems directly and forcefully, not to pass them on to other presidents and other generations.
The U.S. military says that two soldiers have been killed and four injured in Sadr City, the same part of town in which a car bombing Thursday left 10 people dead.
As we look out at a still uncertain and dangerous landscape, as we recall the soldiers and civilians killed since the direct military campaign ended, as we think of the United Nations personnel and the relief workers who have died, we have to acknowledge that moral vision is harder to convert into reality than we should like.
The Iraqi Governing Council, I do not believe, has had a vote opposing Turkish troops in Iraq.
I want to be the people's governor. I want to represent everybody. I believe in the people of California, and I know that together we can do great things.
Wes Clark, welcome to the Democratic presidential campaign. Look, none of us are above questioning.
The Norwegian Nobel Committee has decided to award the Nobel Peace Prize for 2003 to Shirin Ebadi for her efforts for democracy and human rights.
I am addicted to prescription pain medication. I first started taking prescription painkillers 5-6 years ago when my doctor prescribed them to treat post-surgical pain following spinal surgery.
And there's a week. Vice President Dick Cheney today continues a week-long White House of PR offensive defending the war in Iraq. President Bush hits the re-election campaign hustings in New Hampshire. More deaths in Iraq. On Thursday, two more GIs were killed in an ambush. 94 U.S. soldiers have now been killed since the end of major combat operations was announced. Britain honors the 50 British soldiers killed so far in Iraq. Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, told the assembly, which included the Queen and Tony Blair, that it is time to evaluate the Iraq war and its consequences. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld plays down reports that some members of the Iraqi Governing Council are upset that Turkish troops will be deployed within Iraq's borders. Arnold Schwarzenegger is elected governor of California, as Gray Davis has recalled. Wesley Clark finds himself the target of attack at yesterday's Democratic debate. Iranian human rights advocate and lawyer Shirin Ebadi wins the Nobel Peace Prize. And conservative talk show host Rush Limbaugh acknowledges on his radio program today that he is addicted to painkillers. What next, Jack?
What next, indeed? The Washington Post today had two headlines. One, Iraq has deadliest day in a month. Attack kills three GIs, diplomat, eight police. Another headline, Bush urges public to be upbeat on Iraq. Situation term better than perceived. that underlines the president's problem. He's in competition with the realities on the ground, at least the ones that make the news in Iraq.
And they've been working on exactly that competition all week, putting a sort of all hands on deck to put the message up that it's better than it looks. And yet, as you say, those other headlines continue to drip, drip, drip.
They do. And the Bush headline was about a speech he delivered in Manchester. We talked about it yesterday. But in that speech, I think he laid out the three main lines of his campaign, the core of it. One, he said, I know that New Hampshire citizens can spend their money better than the people in Washington, D.C. This is saying for tax cuts. And you think about that and you say, by gosh, I know how to spend my money better than any bureaucrat. Of course, I can't, clean the air, inspect the meat, take care of Iraq. But anyway, it's a strong line.
Sounds good.
Sounds good. Another one. Who can possibly think that the world would be better off with Saddam Hussein still in power? Nobody. He's put the Iraq policy right down onto its unexceptionable core. No one thinks that it would be better if he was still around. The question is, what's the price of removing him and whether that was the best thing to do and so on. And then the third line, and we've talked about this some on the show, is the question of leadership. It's the man in the arena line that comes from Teddy Roosevelt about, you can't criticize the man in the arena who has to make the tough choices. The president said, no, we've been through a lot, but we acted. We led. I think we're going to hear a lot about that. You may not agree with me, but I acted and I led.
In all of those, Jack, I'm struck by the way President Bush is boiling things down so far that, as you say, the statements become in some sense unobjectionable. But you can boil things down so far that all the detail that makes a difference is gone.
Yes, that's true. That's true. He was criticized for this in the 2000 campaign, as you remember, that he just boiled things right down to the applause lines. But it worked for him. And I think they're going to go back to it again, because if the other guy starts to debate, well, I concede to you that we're better off without Saddam. Well, then half the argument is over right there. It's pretty smart, actually.
It may work well politically. It depends in part how well the Democrats can respond with a little more nuance on it. Meanwhile, Congress pushing through some very big dollars that the president has asked for step by step there for Iraq.
$87 billion, they're going to vote on it next week. And I hope they look at the UN World Bank report that was issued yesterday. While our taxpayers are asked to spend $5.7 billion on electricity sector and $4.6 billion on water and sanitation, the World Bank estimates that it would be $2.4 billion on electricity and $1.9 billion on water. That's a differential of nearly $5 billion. Why are we spending $5 billion more than the World Bank thinks we need to spend? I hope some senator or congressman brings that up.
A billion here, a billion there. Pretty soon you've got $87 billion.
Pretty soon you've got $87 billion. And our Democratic candidates are ducking that. General Clark was asked, would you vote if you were in Congress for the $87 billion? He says, that's a hypothetical question. Well, for heaven's sakes, General.
If you're running for president, I think that's real. Jack, I was struck by what the Archbishop of Canterbury was saying just now. We heard in the tape from England at this memorial for British soldiers that moral vision is hard to convert into reality. Hasn't that always been the truth?
Oh, boy, isn't that a statement. Ooh.
Well, he leaves us with it, with the sound of the bagpipes and the music in Britain. There will be funerals on the U.S. front as well. Jack, have a great weekend.
Thank you, and you too.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.